Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Earlier this week, President Obama returned to Fort Hood, Texas, to attend the memorial for three soldiers killed in last week's attack, in which 16 people were also wounded by Army Specialist Ivan Lopez, who then killed himself. 5 years ago, the nation was mourning another massacre at Fort Hood. So on today's Media Roundtable, we're going to spend the hour scrutinizing coverage of that event and how journalists tell stories about the military and the veterans who seek services from the country they served. Do veterans feel invisible in mainstream media, except in extreme cases like mass shootings? How should media spotlight this population that has been so affected by the decade of war in Afghanistan and Iraq, while civilians at home have barely noticed? And joining us to talk about all of this from Maryland, we've got Leo Shane, who's an award-winning reporter for the congressional reporter for the Military Times. In 2010, Shane was part of a team of reporters who received a Polk Award and a National Headliner Award for stories that revealed the military's practice of profiling journalists in Afghanistan in an attempt to steer coverage of the war. Hi, Leo.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being with us. And in studio, I'm joined by Aaron Glantz, who's an award-winning investigative reporter covering veterans and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Glantz has spent more than 10 years covering the Iraq War and the treatment veterans receive when they come home. He's the author of three books on the war, most recently, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And earlier this month, the Center for Investigative Reporting won the George Foster Peabody Award for Aaron's investigation into the VA's pain pill habit. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Hi, Aaron.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. So we always start our media roundtables with kudos to journalists who've done an outstanding job this week. So why don't you get us started, Aaron? What did you see here or read this week that you want to spotlight for us?
Well, I wanted to call your listeners' attention to this incredible project that the Washington Post has going called After the War. So there's a whole series of stories. If you go and you Google Washington Post and After the War, you'll see it. And it really represents the only major initiative by one of our big media to capture what's happening with the 2.6 million Americans who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the basis of it is this poll, the first ever poll done of Iraq and Afghanistan vets that the Post did in collaboration with the Kaiser Family Foundation. And there's lots of findings. I would urge people to check it out. The most interesting to me, as somebody who worked in Iraq as a journalist and has now been covering vets, is this duality that the Post found, where 90% of veterans are very proud of their service and would do it all over again. But at the same time, 35%, so a minority, believe that one or both of the wars should never have been fought. So they're proud of fighting in wars
That they think shouldn't have happened.
And anyone who is a veteran themselves or is a family member of a veteran will immediately understand this bizarre duality that happens when you serve your country. And I think as a country need to think more about this ourselves before we send people off.
Do you know at all if there was anything, is a similar dynamic with the Vietnam War, for example?
Well, I think definitely there was with the Vietnam War. I mean, that was a war which had a large percentage of the service members at the time in open rebellion over some of the orders they were told to carry out and extremely dissatisfied with the war. Those were draftees, right? This is an all-volunteer military, so it's a different situation. So I think that's one of the things that makes it especially interesting that, here we have a whole, million, 2 million and a half people who signed up for the military of their own volition. 90% would do it all over again, but only 35% believe that both of the wars should have been fought.
And Leo, what kudos do you want to give out this week?
I'll tell you, that Washington Post series was really unbelievable and is worth all of your listeners' time. I've been excited this week to see a lot of pushback from the Fort Hood story from veterans. We've seen in the past a lot of folks jumping to assumptions about the role that mental health plays and the long-term effects of the war. So I've seen quite a few editorial pieces, and in particular one by Alex Horton, an Iraq War veteran, in The Guardian this week, I believe it was titled "Let's Make the Latest Fort Hood Shooting the End of the Myth of Military PTSD and Violence." It really is an interesting look at, I guess, how we all stereotype veterans, how society tends to think what PTSD is, what it means to come back from war, and the burdens from that. And it's been interesting to see that narrative out there when in recent years that message hasn't necessarily been prevalent.
And I wanted to highlight an article that I read in Mother Jones by Mariah Blake. The White House broke its promise to victims of the first Fort Hood shooting. Will history repeat itself? And I wanted to ask you both about this story. In 2012, 150 Fort Hood victims and family members filed a lawsuit against the Department of Defense for reckless disregard of the victims of that shooting. And the Mother Jones article talks about the fact that the Army labeled it a workplace violence incident, which means that people who were injured in that don't get the same kind of benefits and treatment that people who were wounded in combat would get. And I found this to be really shocking. I wonder if you could both comment on that piece of this story.
Sure. Well, the classification of the shooting has been a political hot potato for years. There's been quite a few conservative lawmakers who have wanted it labeled an act of war, an act of terrorism, quite a few Democrats on the Hill who have seen political undertones to that and have pushed back. But really, we've seen a couple different stories now over the years of the victims getting caught in the middle, certain benefits, certain treatments, even certain medical care being denied or delayed to them. With the new shooting, the same questions rise again. What are these folks entitled to? How do we treat them? And what services will be available?
Yeah, I guess my reaction, Holly, is people need to understand that there are a lot of more American service members have died in America than in Iraq and Afghanistan combined over the last decade. You know, we're talking about incidents. You know, there's only been this one other mass shooting at Fort Hood besides the one we just witnessed. But, you know, murders, suicides, disproportionate number of car accidents, motorcycle accidents, illnesses related to the war that people develop after they come home. These people do not, you know, have that classification as having died in combat or died of wounds related to combat, and it presents a whole series of issues for the families of these 10,000 individuals. And the folks who died in the Fort Hood massacre in 2009, their families are maybe just the high-profile a group within that larger universe.
Well, I think that's why it's so shocking, because they are so high profile and still are encountering some of these same issues that a lot of veterans have found in terms of obstacles to getting the care that they need that you've been reporting on so much in the past few years.
Yeah, I mean, the VA and the military, and it's important to really underscored that these are two separate systems. The shooting at Fort Hood happened on a military base and involved people who were active in the Army. The same thing in the 2009 Fort Hood shooting. And then once you get out, then you're a veteran and you're dealing with the VA. And so both of these bureaucracies can be extremely intransigent, even in high-profile situations. And you're right, it does kind of call into vivid relief the day-to-day of many people who do not have kind of like both the burden and the benefit of being in that high-profile situation.
And Leah, let's talk a little bit about the coverage of this last week's shooting at Fort Hood. You mentioned what you called the myth of military PTSD. And I know that in the first days of the shooting, that was a really big narrative that that Lopez was seeking treatment for PTSD. So what's your analysis of the coverage of this so far?
Yeah, I think this time it's been a little bit calmer than we've seen in the past. Often, if there's any shooting that involves a veteran or a member of the military, folks immediately jump to the did he serve overseas? Does he have PTSD? Sort of the as they call it, the Rambo narrative. And I think this time you saw some of that initially, but the military folks, the folks at Fort Hood, we're quick to say, he was receiving some treatment. He did have some mental health issues, but that wasn't necessarily connected to the crime that occurred here. And As more details came out, they more definitively said they don't think that his mental state was the driving factor. That seems to be a conflict between him and some other soldiers on base. But veterans groups for years have told me they see this as coloring everything veterans do when they come back. A PTSD diagnosis is a scary mark to have on your record if you're looking for a job, if you're going to school, even if you're just talking to new neighbors in the neighborhood. Their concern is that since we are such a segmented society now when it comes to military and veterans, unlike past wars, there's a much smaller percentage of the country that has served and really understands what it means to serve. Their concern is that there's just unfamiliarity, and everything points to a scary, angry veteran that can snap at any time. VA this week this week and last week pushed out some more information they've had in the past that shows there's not a direct link to this kind of mass violence and post-traumatic stress and depression and some of the other issues that folks are going through. And I think, I think we're starting to see some turns in that, a little bit more understanding, a little bit more information out there about what it means to return from war and to be changed but not to be broken.
Hmm. Aaron, is there anything that you've noticed that you wanted to highlight about the coverage and maybe how it has evolved in the days after that shooting last week?
Well, I think that I was very critical of the media response of wanting to have all the answers right away. You know, we wanted to come out, like, people were calling me for, my analysis right after. I was like, this just happened. You know, we don't know anything about this guy. You know, as time has gone on, we've learned a little bit more. Certainly, if being in a war led to mass shootings at home, with 2.6 million Americans having served in war and two mass shootings, you know, one does not equal the other. I think that this needs to be thoroughly analyzed as the isolated incident that it was. And it doesn't mean that there's no link to PTSD and the war or the brain injury that this individual also apparently suffered, according to him. But it also doesn't mean that, a large number of people who come home from war are going to start shooting everyone in their path.
That's Aaron Glantz. He's an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he covers veterans. We're also joined by Leo Shane, who's an award-winning reporter for the Congressional, he's an award-winning congressional reporter for the Military Times. And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And we want to invite you to join our conversation about the week's news. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. That's 866-798-8255. We're focusing on coverage of military issues and veterans, and we want to know what your initial reaction was to the second mass shooting at Fort Hood last week. How are you making sense of the unfolding story, and where are you looking for coverage? 866-798-TALK. And if you're a veteran or active duty military, how do you view media coverage of these events, of PTSD, of military unemployment? What would you do differently? What do you think is done well? 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you're a civilian, how do you react when you hear stories about veterans? Do you want to hear more, or do you tune out? You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Leo and Aaron, what do veterans and active military tell you about how they feel about media coverage and what they would like it to look like? Do you hear any of that feedback?
Oh, sure. I mean, I hear plenty of pushback that they, the media helps perpetuate this narrative. Some of it is selective reading. Some of it is warranted criticism. Again, just like any other segment of society, there's a lot of reporters who don't understand the military, who don't cover veterans on a regular basis, and we'll see some of these headlines, and we'll jump to the same conclusions. Aaron just talked about, getting calls in the immediate aftermath for commentary on the Fort Hood shooting. That's the nature of some media reporting today. Is what's the instant? What can we get right away? And whatever the first fact you find out becomes the easy explanation for things. So there's frustration for that. It's a much larger issue than just veterans reporting. But they also feel that there's just that lack of understanding. Um, per, heard plenty of veterans say, you know, they're frustrated that when they come back, they are portrayed as this sort of broken character, or they're compared to the Vietnam generation and assume they'll have the same long-term mental health adjustment issues that have been perpetuated in movies and stories and whatnot.
What do you hear from people, Aaron?
I hear that America doesn't care, you know, that because there's no draft, nobody's paying attention, that, you know, they served in a war in Afghanistan or Iraq, and it's not on the front page when they come home, and it's not on the television. And I remember in December 2011, when the U.S. left Iraq, I mean, this is like the end of an eight-year-long war. I get a call from a friend of mine who served with the Illinois National Guard in Iraq in 2003 and 2004, and he's like looking for the coverage. You know, the war,
this major longest war in U.S. history.
It's like ending, you know, and you know, there's like a little segment on Good Morning America, and you know, a few articles in the paper on the inside, and that was it. And you know, my own concern is, since we're already kind of forgetting about this war in Afghanistan while it's still going on, that when, you know, all major U.S. combat operations, or at least most of them, are over by the end of this year, and we have either no force or a skeleton force behind, that the only time we'll hear about these issues at all is when there's a tragedy like the one that we just saw at Fort Hood.
Well, and how do you both as journalists get the public to care about this niche population in a war where most of us civilians had no consequences whatsoever?
Boy, if I had the answer to that, I'd be rich and famous by now, wouldn't I? It's tough. It's tough to get folks who don't understand the military and aren't familiar with a lot of it to engage on it. And you know, as Aaron said, I've especially with Afghanistan, I've heard that folks have this feeling that the war already ended several years ago. So I think one of the things that you're starting to see more papers attached to and pay attention to are these veteran stories, are some of the readjustment stories, some of the difficulties veterans have with VA, with healthcare, and seeing those as stories that are in their communities now. It's a lot easier to cover folks who live next door than it is to cover folks in Afghanistan. So I feel like we're starting to see some more of those stories, but gosh, I'd love to see more of them, and I know the veterans I talk to would love to see many, many more.
Well, and let me ask for help from our audience. Why do you tune out? What would make you tune in? What, call us anonymously. What about veterans is making us tune out en masse, and what could journalists do differently that might get your attention? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Do you want to answer that question before I go to calls, Aaron?
Well, I mean, one thing that I've found to be quite successful since I joined the Center for Investigative Reporting 2 years ago is to try as often as is possible to accompany the stories that we do with interactive maps that really do show what the situation is like in every community across America. Because as Leo said, there is quite a bit of interest by local papers, local television, et cetera, in covering veteran stories. But because they have no reporter who's on the beat regularly, it's kind of a neglected area. They don't really know how to attack it. And so, for example, when we put out a map that showed how long veterans were waiting for benefits in every community in the country, media outlets across the country started to cover it. We just had a story in the last week and a half about the 1,000 wrongful deaths in VA hospitals in the decade after 9/11, and it ran on the front page in the Seattle Times, in the Chronicle here in the Bay Area, in the Oregonian, in the Dallas Morning News, in a number of other papers. And the reason for that was that we ran it alongside a map, and I was able to share some of the documents on each local hospital with those papers, so that it wasn't far away. You know, the mm-hmm. war was actually in their community. It was in Oregon or in the Bay Area or in Dallas. And in that way, it was made more relevant.
And let me go to Deirdre in Oakland. Hi, Deirdre. Welcome to your call.
Hello. I deal with PTSD every day. And, in myself. And it seems rather naive for soldiers to go into combat and not expect PTSD as a result. There's a lot of denial in this country about feelings, about PTSD. The military is a male-dominated organization. I think even the training is a series of brainwashing. You know, there are brainwashing techniques used. I would think anybody would have PTSD from just that military training. So, you know, males are taught to sublimate feelings, and especially in the military. So there's just an immense amount of denial in the society in general, but the military even more so. So PTSD, I think that's, if anybody goes into combat, they're going to have to expect something like that.
And let's get a response. Thank you so much for calling, Deirdre. Yeah, so just the aspect of serving in the military is PTSD.
I think that going to war changes you. There's no doubt about it. And there's been this move amongst people who talk about PTSD to try to drop the D, which is disorder, off of the conversation. And in fact, the former President Bush was just lending his kind of weight behind this. And the reason is because everyone's going to come back from war, you know, watching other people be killed, maybe killing people yourself, you know, in being even in with in the case of Ivan Lopez, you know, who never saw combat, the perpetrator in the Fort Hood massacre, just being on the road driving a truck during our disengagement from Iraq is no fun, is a very could be a very traumatizing experience to many people, not knowing, you know, where fire could come from, even if none actually comes. But just because it's going to change you, and just because it might, you know, cause you to have some of the symptoms, does not mean that you're a wrecked human being for the rest of your life. And everyone is going to be different. And I think that that's something very important for us to consider.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that after a break. You just heard from Aaron Glantz, who's an investigative reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Leo Shane is also with us. He is a congressional reporter for Military Times. We're putting links to all of this information at yourcallradio.org. You can post comments there and put other articles that you think would be of interest for people who care about coverage of veterans, coverage of the military. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back and we'll take your calls. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to share a perspective that you haven't heard yet in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's toll-free, 866-798-TALK. You can also send your email question to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, how much wildlife is left in the U.S.? This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and we'll take a close look at our vast and precious wilderness. Rose will be back to ask you, what is your favorite wilderness place in California or another state? On Tuesday, we'll talk about the UC graduate students one day strike. What conditions are grad students working in, and what do they want to make it better? Today is our weekly media roundtable, and we're focusing on how media cover veterans and military issues. We're joined by Aaron Glantz, who's an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Leo Shane is a congressional reporter for the Military Times. And I'll get to your calls. We have a lot of people on the line waiting to talk to you, but right before the break, we had the call about PTSD, and Aaron was talking about the move to kind of drop the D from this. And Shane, you've said that you it's a myth in some ways. Do you want to just speak to PTSD?
Yeah, I mean, just based off that last caller, and I think Aaron made a great point. There are many people who go to the military, and especially those who deploy overseas, are going to come back changed. But changed is a different word than broken. And I think the caller saying, if anyone who goes in the military, anybody who goes is definitely going to get PTSD. Well, that's one of the myths that veterans are trying to push against. Certainly there are changes, certainly there are adjustments, and anybody who spends a year overseas, combat or not combat, is going to have plenty of adjustments when they get home. The difference is, separating out the folks who have a traumatic experience and, a disorder, not a disorder, from the folks who just need some time to decompress and get back. And I think a lot of veterans worry that they're all being labeled as broken, as somehow damaged goods now, just because they went overseas and served their country.
And a listener writes in and says, can you just tell us what is PTSD? How much do we know about the way it affects soldiers coming back?
Well, there's a lot that we know and there's a lot that we don't know about post-traumatic stress disorder. It's normal to experience symptoms like not being able to sleep at night, reliving the experiences that you had again and again, being hypervigilant, forgetting where you are, being in a dissociative state, in the months after you experience something horrible. The problem comes when these conditions persist over time and begin to damage your ability to function, to hold down a job, to be there for your family, just continue to exist in the way that, we all hope to live a healthy life. One of the things in terms of PTSD that I think that people don't think about enough is the issue of recovery, and the issue of, being down at the bottom and not being able to sleep and, acting out your flashbacks in your sleep and, perhaps a violent way in the home. We're not talking about the kind of thing we shot at Fort Hood, but just domestic violence, other issues like that, getting the treatment you need, recovering, being back in a situation where you're getting the counseling you need or the meds that you need, and then eventually not needing this treatment. That is the role that the VA is supposed to play and that we as a country, should be actively involved in.
And let's go to more calls. Let's go to Andre in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to your call.
Oh, hi, thank you. I have an observation based upon my own experience, and I'd like to ask your viewers, your people to talk about it. I have worked in a couple of different organizations in San Francisco that had, as the leaders of their personnel departments, the officers that had returned from Vietnam. And these men took it upon themselves to go after the union organizing in their organizations, and they would fire people for who knows what reason. I feel that these officers never were adequately reorganized into our society. They come back with this concept of militarism for which they were able to tell people to do things, and they're doing it now in our society, treating our society as if it's a military front. Thank you.
Do you want to speak to that, Leo?
Well, I don't know any of the specifics there. I do know that there, in general, there are some employment adjustments that folks have to make, and the military is a much more structured society. I've heard folks who've had real difficulties getting used to how a normal civilian office place works, and folks who have integrated just fine. There is some adjustment time. Sounds like that's a pretty specific situation that she's talking about there that I'm just not familiar with, but there has been a lot of effort in recent years to talk about how to make that transition, what the difference is between the military environment and the civilian environment is. I talked to a gentleman who's working as an office manager just a couple weeks ago, and he said, one of the hardest things for me to learn was to understand that I couldn't just tell my workers to go do 20 push-ups if they did something wrong. There are adjustments, and you gotta figure those out. It's been a number of years since we've had this many young veterans entering the workforce, and both civilians and the military have had to figure out what does that mean.
And one of the things that we found in talking with veterans is that they are finding it really hard to find employment coming back, and that it's very difficult.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said about how military skills are understood in the civilian world, how familiar they are with writing resumes. I mean, it's a very different world. And if you were an 18-year-old who joined the military, who went to Iraq and is getting out at 25 and 26, you know, you're 6, 7, 8 years behind where your peers are in understanding the game of finding a civilian job.
Yeah, and a lot of this is playing out now on college campuses because, you know, if you went into the military and then you went into the infantry and you served in Iraq in the infantry or in Afghanistan and now you're out, unfortunately, you didn't learn that many employment-ready skills in the infantry. But the good news is that the GI Bill that was passed for Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and went into force in 2009 is very generous. So people are able to go back to school and learn the skills like they did after World War II. And so
we heard a lot of vets tell us, though, that they feel really isolated on college campuses, very different than their peers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue is, you know, the caller Andre is pointing out the culture gap. You know, and in that case, they're not in the authority position. They're in the student position. They're being judged by their teacher and their fellow students. You know, they are used to a more disciplined environment than maybe their students. And they're older. You know, they're 6, 7 years older than the 18-year-old sitting next to them.
Let's go to Jane in Corte Madera. Hi, Jane. Welcome to your call.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting program. I just wanted to throw out a couple of ideas that I have in the forms of questions. You know, at the beginning of the Iraq War, the W. Bush administration started this embedding business, or maybe it was earlier. I only remember it as far back as the beginning of the Iraq War, and that news reporters had to embed with a particular, I'd never really understood. In other words, they weren't free to go around and take pictures of what they wanted to take pictures of. I grew up during World War II, and of course we had no television in those days, and you had to rely on the movie tone news at the movie theater or when news finally came out in the newspaper. But we saw a lot of pictures and a lot of movies and I don't mean moving picture shows, but movies of war going on in Europe and battles and wounded, and the American people knew pretty much what was going on with our men during that war. But during the Bush administration, I believe they said they didn't want the American people to see all this. My personal thought is that the reason was they didn't want us to know what was going on rather than what our administration was doing, and they weren't really protecting us from the evils of war. And then, so I'd like a comment about that, if you would. And then also this business about this young man at Fort Hood. As I understand it, he went to the exact same gun store that the first officer 3 years ago, or however long it was ago.
5 years ago, yeah.
To buy his gun, and also this latest one was having some mental problems. And in mental health, when I was in nursing school, I learned that there were two factors as far as mental health was concerned. There are predisposing factors, which were factors that during your life that may have led up to your reacting to the precipitating factor. It seems to me that the problem in this country is, number one, we don't know who has mental illness, and we will never find out for sure. Number two, it seems to me that any information about buying guns, why was that man allowed to buy the gun in the same gun store where the first guy bought
it,
and why were they both allowed to purchase them?
Let's get a response, Jane. Thanks. So two very different questions she's referring to. I think it was called Guns Galore is the outlet from which he bought the guns.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that disturbs me the most in terms of the unanswered questions that are still out there on Fort Hood is, as I understand it, this gentleman, Ivan Lopez, had been in the military, in the National Guard, and then also active in the Army for a substantial period of time, which means that you know, the military, you know, you have so many checkups that go on over time. They should have known all about him and his mental state. And, you know, as I see it, if it wasn't the war that caused him to snap because the war was so bad, it's also possible that the war was a contributing factor and that he is somebody who should have never had deployed because, and Jane used the words you know, kind of a predisposition, you know, maybe there's something in that past history that they should have known, that they did know, that they're not telling us yet. And so I'm interested in that. And then on the embedding question, you know, I was in Iraq on and off for 3 years as an unembedded journalist. And I'll tell you that I hold no negative feelings towards my colleagues who embedded, because as an unembedded journalist who was talking to Iraqi people and getting their experiences of the war, I had to stay as far away from the U.S. military as humanly possible when there would be a battle going on, because if I didn't, they would have shot me by accident. And so if my goal as a reporter would have been to cover the American military actions and see what happens, then there's a utility to embedding, because it means that... you know, kind of like all the people you're covering know where you are. They're not going to, you know, you're not going to get caught in the crossfire. They're hopefully going to protect you from getting shot by the enemy. Although there is some censorship that goes along with that, I think we're kidding ourselves if we think there was no censorship during World War II.
That's Aaron Glantz. He's an investigative reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. We're also joined by Leo Shane, who's congressional reporter for Military Times. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And I want to give one more invitation to listeners to join our conversation about coverage of veterans and the military. We're at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. What questions do you have for our guests, and what advice might you offer them as they grapple with covering this complex subject? And if you are a veteran, how do you view media coverage of your military service, the wars, and PTSD? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free line. And Jane brought up, Leo, the issue of the military not wanting us to know what's going on and not doing as much coverage, making sure that this story is out there in the public eye so that people will care about what's happening with veterans, especially since we don't have a draft and it's just these volunteer enlistees who are really bearing the brunt of this, the longest war in U.S. history. So I wanted to ask both of you, what are your approaches to covering this major powerful institution, perhaps the most powerful institution in the U.S. government? What are your approaches to maintaining relationships while blowing the whistle?
Well, yeah, just to jump back for a minute on the embed question, because I did do embeds back in 2006 in Afghanistan, 2008 in Iraq, and I, you know, just to echo what Aaron said, it's different sides of reporting. At the time I was working for Stars and Stripes, we were very much focused on the troops overseas and not so much the larger global picture. There is censorship in access, but not censorship in the stories that get out. I think that the larger issue of information getting out in recent years has been just the the local effect on readers and on viewers. If you know someone who's overseas, you're more likely to read and pay attention to those stories. And in the all volunteer draft, unlike in Vietnam, we just have a much smaller slice of America that's connected to the military and paying attention to them. In terms of covering the Defense Department and the Department of Veterans Affairs, which is the second largest bureaucracy in the country, they're difficult, large organizations that have their own cultures and they have their own way of working. And you know what I've found is, if you understand what questions you're asking, if you know your homework, they're much more likely to respect you. You're much more likely to get some information. The problem has been, as media organizations have trimmed, it's been seen as a luxury. So you have maybe one defense reporter who can cover the Pentagon, who can cover major military bases, who can cover the VA, and just, you know, do the best they can. More folks rely on wire services. More folks rely on just what they can get.
And Aaron, do you want to talk about your approach to covering this powerful institution that can deny you access and put out its own stories?
Well, it's important, I think, you know, we've been talking about Fort Hood earlier and the war itself, and it's always important to differentiate between the military and the Department of Veterans Affairs, because they really are, you know, not only two separate organizations, but they have a really different organizational culture, the two of them, too. The military is always highly responsive, but they often don't answer your question, you know. the VA, you can, like, say...
That's a beautiful way to put it.
The VA, like, you can often just feel like you're banging your head against the wall. And one of the odd things is, now having covered this for, you know, over 10 years, I have more institutional experience with the VA than a lot of the people I'm dealing with at the VA. And so one of the things that Leo brought up is it's important to know the right question to ask. This is true not only because they might be trying to hide from you and you need to use the magic words because they have to give you things under the Freedom of Information Act, but it's also important because the person you're dealing with on the other end of the phone might not actually know what the agency does, which is a problem that I come into contact with all the time. I think the VA has been overly politicized under both Bush and Obama, with some people in relatively high places in terms of distributing information who care more about the reputation of the administration than they do about veterans, and don't necessarily have a lot of knowledge about the way the agency works. And so sometimes I find myself educating the spokespeople about what their, you know, jobs actually involve.
That must be endearing.
And then, you know, you just got to be prepared to be there, like, all the time, like a bad rash, and let them know, I think, that you're never going to go away, and that no matter what they do, you're going to find out anyway.
Be
and
there
so
like
they
a
might
bad
as
rash.
Well tell you right now so that they're not embarrassed if you bust them later.
Be there like a bad rash. Go ahead, Leo.
It's a bureaucracy. I mean, you know, Aaron and I have both covered enough bureaucracies. It's different values, different missions, different goals, but it's still, you know, a lot of people and a lot of moving parts and a lot of confusion. So, you know, I'll tell you, being here in D.C., it's a lot easier to deal with some of the folks at the top of the VA and at the top of the DOD because I'm closer, because I can go knock on certain doors and I can shake hands. But you know, I'm sure folks who cover the Department of Education, Department of Labor have the same headaches that we do. I think there's a bit of a reverence around the military that you know, folks think it must have a higher goal or must be able to escape some of the DMV kind of soul-sucking red tape that that we see in other agencies, and it really can't.
Let's go to more callers. Elizabeth in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call.
Hello, Holly.
Hi.
Yeah, I've been concerned ever since the beginning that this report came out, and even the report of the shooting at Sandy Hook, Newtown. Talking of the Army, U.S. Army, not wanting the public to know a lot about these kinds of incidents, why is no one questioning what medications Ivan Lopez was on? I mean, he was there being treated for PTSD and so on and so forth. I mean, he must have been taking antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds that are known to make people suicidal and murderous. And the U.S. Army must be a huge customer of Big Pharma, and young people being dosed in thousands.
Elizabeth,
antidepressants are a big moneymaker.
Well, Elizabeth, Aaron Glantz from the Center for Investigative Reporting actually recently did a whole series about the VA's pain medication, over-medication, medical neglect. Can you tell us just kind of briefly about that, and then what was the result of
this? Yeah, we again have to differentiate between the VA, which is treating veterans, and the military, which is, you know, overseeing Fort Hood. I would say... it's important to investigate these things, but I've been really shocked at the amount of information we've learned about Mr. Lopez's medical care so quickly. There is a right to privacy that people have, you know, and that we do have to be somewhat cognizant of, you know, in terms of knowing every little detail, no matter how unimportant it may be, about somebody's medical care. I mean, people, a large percentage of people deployed to Afghanistan right now are on antidepressants. Is that a good thing? Probably not. You know, we found that the prescriptions for opiates at the VA had gone up 270% since 9/11. And these drugs, which are similar to heroin, are also being widely prescribed in the military because after you get blown up, they want to run you right back out. And so they need to kill your pain. The question is, what relationship, if any, does all of that have with you know, what we just saw at Fort Hood?
And it might not.
It probably doesn't.
Let's go to Caitlin in Santa Cruz. Hi, Caitlin. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you. Question. Somebody mentioned the soul-sucking red tape.
Yeah. Aaron.
And,
that was Leo,
oh, Leo,
I think.
Yeah, I'll have to claim credit there.
Right. And at what point does the enormous amount of information and how it's classified and categorized sort of cause us to sort of go into a state of denial or just sort of numbness and not want to engage in taking care of our own, you know, unraveling of all of that information? And are there support systems in place like local mental health systems have family information programs so that your family understands what you need to do in order to get the help you need? And it's just at lower levels of informational access that can sort of facilitate some of the unraveling of all of the red tape prior to, you know, getting so frustrated and confused by it that you just can't function anymore.
Yeah, so in recent years there's been at least some recognition from Veterans Affairs folks that the amount of paperwork, let's just say, for filing a disability claim has become overwhelming, and we've seen plenty of stories on the backlog and the headaches that are involved with veterans with that. They have, you know, the administration has tried to roll out some new tools, fully developed claims and some online tools in order to make it a little easier to give folks a better way of tracking what doctor's reports do I need, what income reports do I need, things like that. It's a hefty, you know, it's a hefty bureaucracy, and there's a lot to go through. We've also seen a lot from veterans service organizations reaching out and helping out veterans groups, and that's usually where I end up directing folks when they call and say, how do I, you know, just how do I file a claim, how do I understand this, how do I not get lost in the system. Groups like the Veterans of Foreign War and the American Legion have set aside service officers to actually walk veterans through. And from what we've seen, when you get that outside assistance, you know, the chances of claims going through and getting approved, the stress level, it's all much more positive.
And let me try and squeeze one more caller in. Let's go to David, who's calling from somewhere in the Bay Area. Hi, David. Welcome to your call.
Hi. My name is David, and I'm actually a combat veteran and also in the military for 14 years. And I did want to address the question, you know, how do veterans observe, or, you know, how do we see media coverage about the military?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the media needs to cover a little bit more and focus a little bit more on facts. And one of them is the fact that soldiers are human. I think generally, soldiers and veterans alike, we see this perpetuation of hate, and it's kind of evident by callers like Deidre and Andre, when they're talking about brainwash and things like that. Those are misguided, misnomers. We have training, but not brainwash. And one of the things that I did want listeners to understand is that there is not brainwash, but the only quote-unquote brainwash would be that, you know, there's a lot of patriotism instilled within the organization. And so one of the tough things for soldiers is to hear things like that sort of targeted against the veteran when we're told that we're doing this for the people, for the country. So it's very tough. It's not really like, you know, Vietnam, where there were, you know, it was a draft and a lot of people went kind of against their will. A lot of people are volunteering for the military to serve in combat, and then we come back to a population that hates the military. Thank you.
You feel like it's a population that hates the military? I think.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, there's a very generalized, misguided, hate. Not necessarily hate, but, you know, there's a lot of misguided understandings of of what the military is and what type of organization the military is. And there's a lot of generalization from the population towards the military because, you know, when there is media coverage, it doesn't really individualize the soldier as a human being. It generalizes as soldiers in the Army, the military, etc.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in, David. Aaron and Leo, we just have a couple minutes left before the end of the show. Do you want to just respond to David? And how can media be more sensitive to covering this stuff? Aaron.
I wrote down the media has to understand that soldiers are human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is the way I approach all my coverage, you know, ever since I started covering the war in 2003 when Saddam was overthrown, which, by the way, the 11-year anniversary of that was April 9th, and nobody seemed to notice. You know, I just covered the same way I would cover, like, a school board, you know? Like, there's all these people, they're all in the school, you know, they have needs and desires and experiences that they want to talk about, and they're basically decent, good people caught in a certain system. And so that's the way I try to approach it.
Leo, you just get 15 seconds to answer David.
You know, I think a lot of civilians think that they did the balance between hating the war and loving the soldiers, but from what I've heard, veterans and military really feel like they couldn't differentiate that, and they feel the criticism of Iraq was directed at them.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Leo Shane, who's a congressional reporter for Military Times, Aaron Glantz, who's an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and the author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. They're both award-winning reporters, and thank you for spending the hour with us. We'll put links to all of that information, the articles we discussed, and more web resources at yourcallradio.org. You can continue to post resources there yourself. I'm Holly Curran, and Rose will be back on Monday. This is Your Call. How can we best protect wildlife? On the next Your Call, we'll mark the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. In 1964, less than 10 million acres of national forest represented the entire national wilderness preservation system. Today, the Wilderness Act protects 110 million acres of national forests, parks, and wildlife refuges, along with the Bureau of Land Management areas. Call and share your favorite piece of existing American wild with us. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.